there, everybody. It is Wednesday, April 11th, 2012, and you are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm Ken. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to find out all about the fun things happening with our little dog and pony radio show. And of course, go to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have much to discuss, so let's get started. Hey, first guest, are you ready to go?
Ready to go.
Let me introduce you. Bill Clegg is a literary agent who lives in New York City. His first memoir, Portrait of an Addict as a Young Man, which I could not put down last week. It was released last year and became a national bestseller. His second work, entitled 90 Days, is being released in hardcover this week. This week, Bill Clegg. And now he's here on our show. Bill Clegg, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thanks for having me.
A book release this week.
A book release this week.
So what does the week even look like for a book release? I can say that I've never had a book release week.
Well, from a distance, it looks like a very eventful thing. And then inside, it's actually probably very disappointing to most people who would imagine it. You know, a book release is sort of an abstraction. It's just the date that it becomes available. So in this case, you know, I have a reading at Barnes & Noble on Union Square.
Oh, yay.
A bunch of interviews that look like this one. And I spent a couple of hours this morning walking around Union Square with a reporter doing an interview. So that's how the week began, and that's pretty much how it will look.
Now, how do you decide what to read there at the Barnes & Noble at Union Square?
Which section of the book to read?
Indeed.
Well, I was told to pick three sections and pick sections that would sort of introduce the story and then at least one part be funny, which I looked high and low in my book, and there's not a lot of funny moments. It's a book about early recovery, which it does have some dark humor, I guess, but it's not necessarily a funny story.
Well, we got to back up. Let's back up and start out with Portrait of an Addict as a Young Man. So as I said, you're a literary agent. You're used to dealing with authors. How did it come about that you said, all right, I've had this incredible experience. I'm going to write about it.
You know, when I was in rehab after sort of hitting my bottom, which is what alcoholics and addicts, you know, sort of refer to as kind of the point of no return, where you either go to rehab or you get arrested or you die. And so in my case, I ended up in the hospital and had very few choices. So I went to rehab and stayed there as long as I could before coming back to New York. And while I was in rehab, I sort of wrote down a lot of what I had remembered about the preceding months, which were a very dark period where I had effectively walked out the door of my life. I had an agency that I loved. I had a partner of 7 years and, you know, lots of friends and clients and things like that. And none of those things mattered as much to me as drugs did at the very end. So I started filling these notebooks to just kind of remember the details of those preceding months, and I put them down after rehab and then spent a year getting sober and never looked at them really. And then after about a year, I went back and looked at them, and it just unlocked a whole new sort of flood of memories. And somewhere in that period, the shape of a book suggested itself, and then I sort of just became its slave and just felt like I needed to finish it. It was something that just sort of had to be completed.
To what degree do you connect? Is that person that you're reading about, do you feel like that's you? Does it feel like somebody else? Where is the connection there?
Oh, no, it's definitely me. As uncomfortable as it may be to recognize sometimes, it's definitely me. And I don't really ever get too far away from that. I mean, it's been over 7 years since the period of time that's described in Portrait of an Addict. But yet, you know, my recovery, my ongoing recovery is built on a daily sort of engagement with that time and the time that preceded it. So, you know, I never want to get too far away from the memory of active addiction and all of the pain and difficulty that it brought, because I'll forget and then I'll think that I can drink and use drugs safely, which I can't, and I'll risk relapse. So I stay close to that character, who is me.
Yeah. Other than the great opportunities I have on this show to speak with authors, you know, usually I don't have the opportunity, as most folks don't, to speak to the author of a book that they've read. So I will give you the opportunity. I'm feeling very impressionable this week. Tell me what you want me to get from Portrait of an Addict, because it's an intense read. What do you hope that people put down the book and say?
You know, both of the books that I wrote are written for primarily for addicts and alcoholics. And so Portrait was written for people it's dedicated to everyone who's still out there. And by out there, I mean not in recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And so if somebody read that book and recognized themselves at any point along the way, I mean, I struggled for so many years to control my drinking and my drug use. And there were so many consequences. I got thrown out of college. I mean, there's just so much wreckage. And if they recognize themselves in that story, they can see where my story went, which was to a hotel room where I tried to kill myself after 2 months bender. And that's not a place I want anybody to get to. If they see that that's where my story went and they recognize themselves, particularly in that struggle to control it on their own, then maybe they might see that that's where it's going for them too, and step off earlier and avoid maybe some of the great wreckage that I had to go through, it seems, to get sober. So I think the reason why identification is so important and powerful is that, you know, when I was an active alcoholic and drug addict, I really was persuaded that I was the only person who struggled in the way that I struggled. I was really convinced that I was this lone, singular person who couldn't handle alcohol and drugs in the way that I did, and that nobody, you know, who struggled particularly with crack cocaine, which was my drug of choice,
right,
you know, had a day job like I had, walked into an apartment building like I went to, and I just sort of looked around every room I was in and sort of imagined that, you know, people's lives were, you know, so much less complicated and unfettered. And the truth of the matter is, particularly now that I'm in active recovery, you know, there's nothing terribly original about my story. Every building in New York City, from the projects to Park Avenue, has addicts and alcoholics.
Right.
And, you know, what they wear and how they sound may be different, but the experience of it is the same.
Portrait starts out right after you write For Everyone Still Out There with actually one of my favorite quotes, the William Kittredge quote, "Think of light and how far it falls to us. To fall, we say, naming a fundamental way of going to the world, falling," which is a much different meaning when you start out the book than when you end it.
Yeah, I had to fall far to actually be able to walk on this earth in any kind of successful way, and I nearly wasn't able to stand up from that fall. If I'd had my way, I wouldn't have stood up. I was, you know, 34 years old, and I felt like I was 200 years old, and I was tired from the struggle. And I felt very sorry for myself, and I didn't see a way out, and I had no tools to break the cycle that I was in. And so without tools and without enough of an imagination to see my way to some other kind of life or some other way of living, I decided to try and kill myself. And, you know, when I first started to get sober and came into, you know, other rooms where people were trying to get sober, I was so embarrassed of the fact that I had tried to kill myself. I thought that that was just, you know, yet another thing to be ashamed of.
Mm-hmm.
And then very soon after, I just, you know, started listening to people, and so many other people got to that same place. And so I think with the first book, with Portrait, it's just some people succeed. Some people, like, do end up successfully killing themselves because they can't see their way to sobriety.
Right.
So if it plays a part in you know, a longer story of somebody stepping off early before they get to that point, then to me the book is worth it.
Well, my book, my copy sitting right in front of me, is all dog-eared and highlighted and all mucked up because so many different passages just screamed out at me. But I keep coming back to this one pair of sentences that I would love to get your take on, because I think it's so in touch with so many different parts of the gay community. You wrote, "I finally make it downstairs to the bar and am immediately disappointed that the place is nearly empty and dotted with a few couples and business colleagues traveling together. I don't see the vulnerable and restless loner I'm looking for, that magical kindred partner in crime, game for a long night." You chuckle.
Yeah. Misery loves company.
Yeah.
It's a lonely, lonely place. When, you know, at that point in the story, you know, I had stepped away from my life. I'd left my boyfriend. I had emailed my business partner and said I wasn't coming back. And I was just diving headlong into a bender. And so I had cut myself off from everyone, and yet I didn't want to be alone.
Right.
And so, and, you know, when I was using and drinking before I had actually walked out the door, it was the same thing. I mean, I would, you know, always try and find some, you know, little corner of the world that had people who were like me, that were, that used and drank like I did, and didn't want it to end. And, there was, I mean, even now when I meet sober addicts, especially crack addicts, for some reason, because there's so much shame attached to that when I, was using, when I meet them now, there's just this instant kind of kindred bond. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the beauty of recovery, is that, like, I was looking for people who drank and used like I did, and who would, you know, through sex and through drinking and drugs, would create an oblivion to sort of, like, make me not feel all these lonely, ashamed, tormented feelings that I was feeling. But now, like, you know, I'm sober and I don't have those things to take me out of myself. And I know all of these addicts who are sober now, and we're, you know, we're still, in so many ways, we're the same people.
Right.
You know what I mean? Just without the drugs and the alcohol. And so when we recognize each other now, kind of living our lives, like, you know, going to jobs and having relationships with other people successfully, oftentimes for the first time in our lives, like, you know, there's just this feeling of, like, oh, God, you got through the war, too.
Right.
Like, and it's just, it's the best feeling in the world. But underneath it is that same kind of, like, that wanting to connect that I felt going down to that bar. Like, so alienated from the world, so kind of like it was a self-imposed exile, and yet I still wanted to connect with somebody and still not be alone. And, you know, I'm so happy to say that now, like, I don't go to bars or crack dens or places like that to find that connection. I find it with other alcoholics and addicts.
Reading through Portrait, it becomes a little bit of a race towards the end. I'm looking at the dwindling page numbers and feeling, you know, less and less on the right-hand side of the book, and still not finding that recovery place. And I'm, there's actually anxiety, that I was experiencing anxiety as I'm running out of pages in the book, because, you know, they're spiraling, and there's just so much going on. And I'm thinking, where's the silver bullet? Where's the magic ending? And I'm quite gratified to hear that you took the time to write 90 days, because I think that that is an important piece of this puzzle, is it not?
Yeah.
And I will say that one interesting piece about that is that in Vanity Fair, you know, when they wrote about Portrait, they wrote, quote, "He finally hits bottom and takes the first steps to recovery, though he tastefully skimps on the particulars of his redemption."
As if going into the details of recovery would be tasteless. Right?
Exactly. And I took exception to that particular sentence, because I work with students and their alcohol issues, and we talk daily about recovery and what works about it for some students and what doesn't. And I wanted more of that. And so what was it always the plan to write 90 days?
No, in fact, I when I was writing Portrait of an Addict, I was also resurrecting a career. You
right.
know, I was given a job at the end of that book, but I didn't have any clients.
Right.
And it was a real Jerry Maguire moment. I was given this office in this high powered agency with an assistant and all this stuff, and I didn't know any of the other agents there. Mm. I didn't even really know the person who hired me, and it was really a strange thing, and but they knew who I was, because I'd left in such a gloomy, messy cloud of calamity.
Right.
And so I had this terrible reputation, and so I arrived with no client, and, you know, the phone wasn't ringing. So I had to begin again. So, which was simultaneous to the time that I was beginning to write Portrait. So when I finished that book, you know, 3.5 years later, I didn't think there was space to write anything else mm-hmm. in my life. I mean, it just, and so, but I had this very strong feeling of not being done, and I just kept on writing and kept on writing and just didn't impose any expectation on it. I just thought, well, maybe I'll just write this out mm-hmm. just for me, and then just, like, then I can be sort of afraid of this. And then it just wouldn't go away. And I remember talking to my boss, who was also my agent, and she asked to see those pages. And, you know, we had a long talk about it. And, you know, my main, you know, sort of question was like, can it be useful? Will it be? That was my main question with Portrait of an Addict. I didn't have a choice to write it, but I had a choice to put it in the world.
Right.
And I felt like it could be useful, hopefully. Because I don't think that there's a lot of detailed narrative about active recovery.
There's really not.
I didn't really know that until I kind of like poked around in service of answering that question of whether it could be useful or not. And so I didn't find very much. And so that was the justification for it. And I really had to justify it to myself. So because I have, you know, I have most of those writers who, you know, I abandon in my addiction and alcoholism. And most of those writers I now work with again, and they've trusted me again after I betrayed their trust before. So to justify the time to finish a book, and which is not just writing it, but it's going through the copy edited manuscript several times.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot that goes into a book, and there's having conversations like this. There's, you know, doing bookstore events. There's a lot of time that it takes away from most people. That's their full-time job as a writer.
Right.
And so I had to justify it. And so having done that, I went through with it and finished it to the best of my ability, and I'm showing up to this phase of the story like to the best of my ability. And although there's times where I've wished that I could just have my writers stand in for me and do this part of it because
right.
they're good at it. And I can just go back to my regular job.
You're stuck on the phone with me for a little bit more. You just got to grin and bear through it. Now, I want to talk about your piece in Harper's Bazaar, Social and Sober. I'm quasi-obsessed with just the idea of I've worked with so many gay students who are seeking the recovery process and kind of wading their way through it. And one of the most common complaints is with various forms of recovery, they feel gay. My gay students feel that you have to choose between being sober and being gay, that the social life of a young gay male, of any gay male, is so intricately tied in to alcohol and other drugs that to be in recovery is to sacrifice part of your LGBT identity. And so I want to read a little bit from what you wrote there, which I just thought this passage was fantastic. You wrote, "There is a parallel universe happening right now in New York and pretty much everywhere else. Throngs of people, tattooed, suited, done up, and carefully undone, streaming from their office jobs, photo shoots, classrooms, and gyms into church basements and school cafeterias where they get and stay sober. They duck in, they duck out, and they speckle the rooms of the city, and whether they know it or not, serve as beacons to the newly sober who are finding out finally that they are not alone in their struggle with alcohol and other drugs." Was there any conflict for you in seeking recovery and maintaining a gay identity?
For me, no. My identity as a gay man largely came from the status of my relationship with my boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had been, you know, I had lived with my girlfriend and she was away, and that's when I met my boyfriend, Noah, and then I came out simultaneous to that. So I sort of arrived as a fully baked cake, as it were. It was like, and I didn't even, I less said I'm gay, and I more said I'm in love with someone new, and his name is Noah.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got sober, it was, I had ended the relationship with him and entered into a world of recovery single. And so, but for me, it was much more attached to my place in like the literary community. I felt like drinking was part and parcel of a life in books and in literature. And you know, so much of my socializing for work was geared around drinking. And there were certain relationships that were, you know, that went long into the night with alcohol and drugs. And I also associated whatever it was, whatever talent I had to be empathetic to writers and to anticipate sort of their intentions with their writing, that might have come from whatever this dark side of mine was that needed to sort of like seek oblivion, which all was a big justification to drink and use drugs. None of it was true.
Right.
I see, though, how, I mean, I have a boyfriend who's younger who's also sober, and he came from a community of, you know, nightclubs and gay bars and you know, rave clubs, and just a real, you know, gay social scene, like, that was connected to drugs and alcohol, and certainly nightlife. But I look at his landscape of friends now, and it's like, it's all those same people, just sober. I mean, gay sobriety in New York, there are so many, like, kids in college, just after college, I mean, really young guys and young lesbian women who are sober and who are really active. Like, they take their sobriety so seriously and kind of pursue it in the same way that they pursue nightlife. I mean, they form groups, they go on trips, they, like, I mean, they have sober, you know, evenings. There's just, it's really, really social.
That's great.
And so I think anybody who's worried about that, if their life is so connected to that, they can take comfort, particularly, I think, in the cities where, you know, a lot of gay kids go, if they grow up in the country. But,
yeah.
But it's just in my experience that there's a much, and there's a lot less hang-ups about it with the young women and men, in terms of, like, being sober. There's such a full, rich world. And so many evenings, you know, I'll come home from work and my boyfriend will say, God, this guy, you know, he walked into a room of, you know, in one of the rooms of recovery that he goes to, and he's like, I never thought I'd see that guy here. And so they just keep coming in, and he's there to say, hey, you know, it's like they used to drink and use, and they used to stay up all night in the clubs, and now they're all, you know, they're all sober.
Well, memoir number one out last year, memoir number two out this week. How does that change you as an agent? I would imagine that you are a lot less tolerant of people not meeting deadlines, because now you can say, whatever, dude, I've done it.
maybe sometimes, because I'm really impatient. But the truth is, I also realize most of the writing that I work with is, you know, sort of aspires to be literature, and you know, people who write literature, or, you know, I also know it takes what it takes. It does. And so, you know, sometimes not writing is one of the necessary, like, phases that that's part of the creation of a novel. And so I can usually sense when people are, you know, sort of shirking their responsibilities. But most of the writers I work so hard, and it's and they're spilling their guts out every day, and then exposing themselves to sometimes a very small community of readers, and it may take years for them to complete that book. So, you know, I have high expectations, and I'm tough on them in some ways, but nobody's tougher on them than themselves.
All right, because my students are going to listen to you say that, and they're going to say, no, Bill Clegg said I can hand in my paper late.
Yeah, exactly.
He said it takes what it takes.
It's part of the process.
I heard it right there on your show. Bill Clegg said I can get easily another week. I'm creating literature.
I give you all permission.
So,
and I got thrown out of college, so I'm absolutely the worst person to give advice about papers in school.
I might put that right in the description, lest they get the wrong idea about the advice that you are giving. So exactly. 90 days out this week, very exciting. Are we thinking, am I going to finish 90 days? Because I've not read it yet. I do not have it in my hand yet. Am I going to finish this and say, okay, I need the next 90 days? What sense of completion will I feel?
You'll put it down and just say, enough of Bill Clegg. Enough of this story. Like, I don't want to hear one more damn word about it. So that's how I feel about it. Because unlike the end of writing Portrait, where I didn't feel finished, when I finished 90 Days, I really felt finished.
Like, I'm good.
I don't need to go back to that. Yeah, so maybe you'll feel the same way.
Now, do you have to send it to friends beforehand and say, look, you are mentioned in this, this is what's going to be said?
I did, especially the people who are in my life who are depicted in the book. I did send the manuscript to early, and there's one character, when you read the book, you'll see that her name is Polly, and that relationship was really one of the most important during that first year that I got sober. It's still one of the most important relationships in my life, you know, now 7 years later. And so in her case, she read the manuscript a couple times, and, you know, because partly I wanted to just make sure that I got all the facts right. But of course, like, that wasn't, the problem wasn't that she was like, you know, it kind of gets slow over here, and, you know, you might speed it up over here, and, you know, so she was kind of giving me literary critique, less about her own story. But yeah, I did. I gave it to the people who I had access to still, who I could reach and who were featured prominently.
Well, I am excited to get my hands on it. I mean, this show is about nothing if not people using their voice to get other people to look at their own voice and see what kind of change they can create. And I'd be hard pressed to think of a better example than Portrait of an Addict as a Young Man. And when I get my hands on it on 90 Days, this is one man using his voice, telling his own story and through it. And my assumption is you've gotten a ton of feedback from people who are in recovery to Portrait who said, thank you for writing this.
I have had a lot of feedback, and somehow people have read 90 Days, even though it's not officially released, and I've gotten a lot of emails and Facebook messages and stuff like that, and which is really, like, my favorite part in the whole process, because, you know, there's been a lot of people have been affected by not just my using and my drinking and all of the consequences around that, but around the writing of these books. And so I really have to believe that they're of value to somebody, and that's the reason why they exist. So when I get letters that say it's helped them get sober or stay sober or understand sobriety better than they did, then it's a real comfort. So I get a lot of emails. Sometimes it's weird. I'll be on the subway and somebody will, when it's really quiet in the subway, like say, oh, I loved your book. Thank you so much for writing
that's
it.
Great.
And then it's like, okay, back to normal.
Right.
So, but I'm grateful. I'm grateful for anybody who spends the time to read it, and I'm grateful if it's helpful to anybody.
And on behalf of the whole community, we're grateful to you. I mean, let this be a lesson to anybody listening. You tell your own story. That's the story that you can tell, and through telling your own story, it's unbelievable what change you can create. So, Bill, thank you so much for telling your story and for putting yourself out there and letting us get a glimpse into your process, because it really will help just untold numbers of folks.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Have a very exciting week, hardcover release week.
Okay.
I'm turning it into something much more exciting than you seem to be feeling.
You celebrate up there.
Yes, we, for folks that are listening, this Saturday we will be having the hardcover release party of 90 Days here at my apartment. So, Brattleboro, Vermont, the mecca of that kind of release. All right, so folks, troll on over to anywhere fine books are sold and pick up a copy of Portrait of an Addict as a Young Man and the sequel memoir, 90 Days. Bill Clegg, an absolute treat having you on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Security, feeding the cancer of my intellect, the blood of love soon neglected, lay dying in the strength of its impurity. Meanwhile, our friends we thought were so together, they've all gone and left each other in search of fair weather. We sit here in our storm and drink a toast to the slim chance of love's recovery.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, for the past year, I have been following a court case out in California that really captures the perpetual fight to get the voice of the LGBT community heard in all aspects of society. Now, please note, in this segment, we will be talking about issues involving rape and police brutality, and as much as I want you to stay listening and hear this vitally important story, I know such topics can be triggering for certain individuals, so please make your decisions to stay with us accordingly. That said, instead of me telling you about the case, I'm most pleased to welcome the man at the center of the proceedings, James Hornick. Welcome to this show, Is So Gay.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
Now, I will tell you, James, that in hundreds of episodes of this show, Is So Gay, and hundreds of guests, I usually end the interview by thanking the guests, but I'm going to flip things up and thank you at the start. As truly, James, I could not have more respect and admiration for your bravery in using your voice in the way that you have used it.
You know, one thing I learned very early on was that basically if I don't do this for myself, nobody else is going to do it for me.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine has always said that you are your own best advocate. And it was those things that motivated me to pick up this fight, because I could see that nobody else was willing to touch it.
Yeah.
Well, before we talk about the fight and before we get into the details, you undoubtedly knew that I was going to ask you to tell your story, and we'll get to that. But I would love to take a step back for a second and have you talk a little bit about you. How do you prepare yourself to tell what is essentially your own story?
Wow. Usually, I have to kind of, separate myself a little bit from the situation.
Okay.
And almost kind of view it as a, like a third person type thing, as if I was just watching. The reason being is because I've had to tell this story so many times through interviews and with doing all the stuff in court and everything else that for a while there it just became like, re-traumatizing.
Yeah, you know? I bet.
And I just had to learn to try and separate myself somewhat from it so that I could share the story but not be, you know, essentially re-victimized over and over every single time.
Well, I give you the power, sir. I give you back the power to tell your story the way that you are comfortable telling it. Where should we start folks off?
Well, I guess basically just from the beginning. You know, I had spent a few weeks in Hollywood. A friend was working on a project, knew I had past experience construction, and they needed advice. So I came down. I wasn't getting paid anything, so I'm putting money out to stay in hotels. And so eventually someone, you know, directed me to a hostel. And the idea of paying $25 a night versus, you know, $120 a night was obviously a lot more economical.
25 is less.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes, quite a bit less.
Yeah.
So I chose for the one and only night that I stayed at the hostel. It happened to be August 30th. And I don't know if most people know how a hostel works, but it's not like it's a traditional hotel or motel where you have your own private room, your own everything like that. This is more of a dormitory style setting where there's multiple beds per room, usually 2 to 6 beds, sometimes larger.
And this is 2009?
Yes.
Okay.
The Gay and Lesbian Center there told me it was a safe place to stay because I was over the age limit of people allowed to stay at the center.
Okay.
So I went, checked in, got my room. The roommate wasn't there. I only had one roommate for the evening. So I left, walked around Hollywood for a while. I met up with a friend and had a drink to celebrate his new lease on a place. Went back to the hostel, and as soon as I met the roommate, seemed like a very nice guy, but it reminded me more of like a typical conversation you would find in a gay chat room.
Huh.
Where nobody asks your name. Instead, immediately they want to know what your role is, you know, sexually speaking.
Gotcha.
What you're into, what you're not into. You know, I know people who are like that, but I don't talk that way to people, especially people I don't know. I had had a long day, so I essentially decided to kind of like do the polite thing and, you know, go and just kind of like politely avoid the situation, you know, and I went and took a very long shower. I suffered from insomnia for many years, so I took my usual sleeping medication.
Okay.
That, I would say, might have been a slight mistake because I did have the drink earlier. And, you know, being from the beach, it's about 20 to 30 degrees cooler than it is in L.A. So I was a little dehydrated, you know, took a hot shower. The pill hit me a lot harder than normal. You know, I remember going to bed, wearing my shorts, socks, underwear, and a shirt. And I had the bed sheets and stuff that were provided. And when I woke up in the morning, I woke up because I could tell the room was light, but my alarm had not gone off because I did have a meeting to attend that morning. Immediately, I just jumped up and I realized, I have no bed clothes. Like, you know, my blankets are gone. My shirt and shorts have been removed. My socks have been removed. And all I have is basically my underwear down around one ankle.
Okay.
I immediately jumped up, you know, like, you just think confusion, trying to figure out what the heck is going on, what happened, why am I like this, what's going on. And I realized that I was bleeding a little bit.
Okay.
And, I had lube on me. And, it was just all downhill from there. I just went into panic mode. I kind of froze for a while in the hallway, wasn't sure what to do. And then I realized that I needed to do something because this same type of thing had happened to me as a young boy, and I had always vowed that, you know, if anything like this happened again to a family member or a friend, that I would do something about it instead of not doing something about it, which is the outcome of what happened to me as a child.
Right.
And so I called. I actually went up to the front desk, explained to the front desk lady that I do believe my BlackBerry's been stolen and that I was taken advantage of in my sleep. And she was kind of, well, what do you mean? You know, she wasn't sure. It was kind of a language barrier because she's from Europe. I explained to her further that, you know, my clothes had been taken off and I had been taken advantage of sexually in my sleep. And she directed me to call 911. I made a mistake of not saying the words rape in a 911 call.
Okay.
I started to explain about the phone, and the 911 operator basically asked, well, do you need the police? And I was like, yes, ma'am, right away. Essentially, she just transferred me to the front desk at the police department. So the recording ends there.
Oh, okay.
From there, I waited 3.5 hours, and the police never showed.
Wow.
During that time, I sent out emails to my phone to try and track it. I contacted AT&T to try and track it. I sent emails to my brother and my mother and a family friend. I reviewed the security video with the front desk lady. And it was only the last 20 minutes that I was there that she pointed out that this person had actually, as she said, abandoned his luggage in the front lobby, hadn't paid for the room for the following night, so she wasn't even sure what she was supposed to be doing with his things. And she had watched me pace back and forth and cry for the last 3 hours.
Right.
So she's like, well, you can take it, you can search it, I'm not going to stop you. So I had her write down his full name, you know, that she had copied down from his passport, and I took his luggage. I told her where I was going to be, which was at the Tiago Cafe, which is on the corner of La Brea and Hollywood. I proceeded to wait there for another 3 hours before police finally arrived. When I was at the cafe, I'd actually run into someone I had seen at the cafe 2 times before. And since it was a familiar face, I just sat down at his table and started talking to him some. And, you know, he was the witnessed the initial contact with the police.
Right.
And then that's where the story gets really interesting because... the officer that testified, the, as I call him, a gay man can't be raped cop, because, you know, that's what he had essentially told me.
Mm-hmm.
He says that I was at the table alone, and that there was nobody with me, and that I never made mention of any comment of rape. Now, his partner, who never testified at my criminal trial, we did his deposition just a few weeks back. He says that I was seated at the table with someone. He doesn't remember me saying that I was raped, but he remembers me saying my phone was stolen and that I had woken up naked. But can't remember any other part of my conversation whatsoever.
Hmm.
So they automatically contradict each other just from the start. They contradict each other. You know, initially the one cop said that he never patted me down. That's what he testified to. And that he was not aware I had medication or I was on medication. Then at the deposition, he changed his story and said, yes, he had patted me down. His partner also admitted to patting me down, initially denying that I had medication and then saying, yes, he did have medication in his pocket. Now, if two officers pat you down, I don't see how they can miss a pill bottle the
right.
size of a roll of a stack of Jouia dollars in your pocket.
Yeah.
I really don't see how that's possible. So it's obvious that they can't even get their story straight.
Well, I read the complaint. I read the complaint, James, and to read something like this is, you just can't fully put, nor do I think that anyone can put themselves in your shoes, but I'm reading and I'm incredulous and it goes on, and then you get to the part not so far where suddenly you get arrested. You just have to pause and say, wait a second, what just happened?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that the one cop testified in court that he did not write it off as some sort of domestic dispute, that he wasn't sure who was telling the truth, but he couldn't remember any of my story other than my phone was missing.
Huh.
So it was his decision to go back to the hostel to investigate further. So we were both put into handcuffs, placed in the car, and taken back to the hostel. Now, that's how what he testified to. But during his deposition, he admitted that the only reason he wanted to return to the hostel was to get video proof of me walking out the door with the luggage.
Okay.
And at that time, I hadn't been told I was arrested. I spent about 2.5, maybe 3 hours in handcuffs before I was really told that I was under arrest.
Okay.
And that I was going to jail for felony theft.
I can't imagine.
I was crying the whole time.
Yeah.
But according to the cops' testimony and their depositions, they say that I was calm, collective, polite, and cooperative the entire time, and then just suddenly out of nowhere attempted suicide.
Right.
But the medical records don't reflect that, and neither does the video from the hospital. Once at the hospital, there was a different worker working the front desk, and so I pleaded with the officers to make sure that they talked to the worker who was there that morning. Basically, the cop, a gay man can't be raped cop, came around the corner and said, "You know what, dude? You're a liar. That lady doesn't even recognize you. She doesn't even remember you."
Hmm.
And I broke down crying and pleading, "Please make sure to talk to the right person." I gave them a description. They did nothing to talk to her. All they did was print out 2 or 3 photos, stills of me walking out with the luggage, and then proceeded to take me out to the car to arrest me.
Okay. You're in the car, and things certainly don't get better, do they?
Well, before we went into the car, there was a 20-minute debate that took place outside the car.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, that's when the officer flat out told me that a gay man cannot be raped. And I just kind of lost it. I broke down, just started crying. I got a little upset and angry, and I kind of, you know, had a tone, and I was like, "Listen, sir, if you took medication and went to bed, and then I undressed you while you were asleep and had sex with you, yes, sir, that is rape because you could not consent."
Right.
And his exact words were to me, "Shut up, you're done, you're going to jail for felony theft. I don't want to hear another word out of your mouth." And then I was put into the police car. I finally just hit my breaking point when I saw the Australian person walk out, the cop shake his hand, and then tell him that, sorry, these sort of Hollywood people do this messed up kind of thing all the time. And I just could not believe it. And then he sent him on his way. And it hit me then that I'm going to jail for theft. Even though I called 911,
right.
I waited for almost 7 hours for the police to arrive. I have proof that my phone was stolen. I'm bleeding rectally and I have lube on me.
Right.
I found lube and porn and other things in his bag and an underwear collection, which I think would have verified my story, especially because he says that he's straight and that we had no sexual contact. So a rape kit would have proven sexual contact did occur.
Right.
You know, and if I'm saying I didn't give consent, he's saying it didn't happen and we have evidence that shows otherwise. To me, that seems very clear.
Yeah.
But according to the prosecutor, it wouldn't have proven anything. And I actually have that in writing from them. So I did attempt suicide. I just had hit rock bottom. I could not fathom how any of this could be real, could be taking place. And I did. I swallowed my sleeping pills and tried to commit suicide.
So you're taken to Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. And from what I'm understanding, one of the problems with Cedars-Sinai Medical Center is that they don't have the ability to perform a rape kit. Is that right?
Yes, there are certain contract hospitals that are contracted, with the police and the county, the city basically, to, be able to do that. And for whatever reason, out of the 3 that are available that they can do that to, I was taken to the one that cannot collect rape kits.
Okay.
And the interesting thing is that even though the city's lawyer is only focusing on the 2 arresting officers, the 2 transporting officers, I also told the same story to in front of one of the ER nurses. And the cop told me, "I don't care what you're here for. I'm just here to transport you. So don't say another word about a rape kit and we'll get along just fine."
Mm-hmm.
And the lady, the nurse, she offered to go get the doctor because she wanted to make sure that some kind of arrangement could be made for a rape kit. And the officer said, "No, the doctor's already released him. We're taking him now." And she goes, "Well, wait." And then she gave them 20 questions, basically, about the sheriff's facility, if they could provide rape kits. You know, the officers admitted they didn't know if they could or not. So the nurse gave the officers the addresses to two separate locations en route to the county jail that could collect rape kits and treat me for the injuries.
Mm-hmm.
Cedars-Sinai had intentionally not removed my pants so that they wouldn't contaminate any potential evidence.
Right.
And yet the officers still chose to ignore the request of the nurse and the medical staff. And to this day, they still say that I never told anybody, but it's reflected in the medical record three different times. You know, there's four people involved before the officers who I've all told I was raped. And there's about four to five people involved after the officers that I directly told I was raped.
Right.
But yet somehow the officers are the only two that say I never made that claim.
Right. Oh, boy.
It's frustrating. It's been a very tiresome battle.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the battle, because there's so many different responses that you could have had, James. And so many, you know, there are other people who, unfortunately, have experienced what you've experienced. And you could just drop everything and just move on with your life. You could, you know, there's so many different options. And you chose the option of, and you said it at the start of the interview, of taking on the fight of saying, look, I need to defend myself and my own experience. And then in the process, as I'm sure you know, you are defending the entire LGBT community. What is it in you that allows you to take on this battle?
It's a combination of things, Ken. As I said, I was raped as a young boy.
Mm-hmm.
And because I was raised in an old-fashioned Pentecostal Church of God type setting by my great-grandmother,
mm-hmm.
obviously homosexuality was not acceptable. And my rapist basically convinced me to not tell anybody, because if I did, then everybody would think I was gay and I would go to hell and nobody would like me anymore. So I never told anybody about that until I was 22 years old.
Okay.
I waited an entire decade. And so the guilt from that, the guilt of knowing that this man probably did this to other boys.
Right.
When I could have spoken up and done something to stop it, and I didn't. The guilt was one of my main factors for swearing to my mother when I was 22 that if anything like this happens to anyone else in our family, I will make a stand and do something about it.
Right. So you've filed suit. So the suit is against County of Los Angeles, Los Angeles police officers, and then certain specific officers as part of that department. Where is the case right now?
Initially, we filed against the county, the city, the LAPD, and all four officers involved. But because of a federal loophole, since the county jail was not the arresting agency, they're only the housing agency, they are immune. And the responsibility falls back onto the arresting agency. So even if nothing happened to me, say like with the LAPD, and something happened at the sheriff's facility, it's still the LAPD's fault because the LAPD put me in the sheriff's facility.
Okay.
So we had to drop the thing against the county. So we're now focused only on LAPD, the city of Los Angeles, and the four individual officers.
Okay.
We filed in state court, and the city made a motion to move it to federal court. The reason being is that the protections on the state level are greater than the protections at the federal level.
Okay.
So they felt we have a weaker case at the federal level. So after it was moved to federal court, they immediately made a motion to have it dismissed, which was denied. They made a motion again on April 2nd to have it dismissed, and I can tell you I have the paperwork here in my hands. It's a book that belongs in a museum. It's about 3/4 of an inch thick.
My gosh.
It really is. And it cites every kind of case and every kind of law and every kind of reason that you can think of why the case should be dismissed. And as a typical prosecutor-type mindset, they focus on just the one or two key facts that support their case, and then anything else that would detract from that, they just ignore as though it doesn't exist or didn't happen.
Okay.
The judge did not grant that. He gave us a few days to come up with a response, And also we explained to the judge that I wasn't in a financial position to complete discovery initially, and I had to go to the public to raise funds, and I've actually been able to acquire the funds necessary now to pay for the case. So, you know, we're letting the judge know that I'm now in the financial position to complete my obligations, and we would just like a few more weeks to be able to do that and then present that to the judge so he can review it when he reviews the motion and make his decision from there.
What can we do, James, as listeners? You know, I could not feel more far away from you right now, and I just want to be right there and say, James, what can we do? What can we do to support you?
You know, I have to say, the hardest part about this battle is the fact that, and I'm not detracting from all the wonderful people on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
They have definitely been my motivation on those days when I can't get out of bed. They give me a reason, you know, to take another breath and wake up and keep going.
Yeah.
The hardest part, though, has been being alone.
Yeah.
I've contacted every LGBT organization you can think of. I've contacted every big name person who's ever done any kind of activism for the LGBTQ community. I've contacted every news organization that I can get an email address for. I've contacted the governor. I have the petition on change.org demanding an apology from the LAPD. That is just been the hardest part. It's just being alone.
Yeah.
I really want more people, not just for me, for my case, but to get involved in these sorts of things, because what reinforced this case to me was just a few weeks ago, a friend of mine who lives here in Ventura had been receiving essentially terroristic threats by text that this person was going to come to their house and rape them. So they came to me for advice. I was like, well, okay, immediately let's call the police. Let's file a report. We'll do a no trespassing warning against the person. And this way it's on file. Do you know what I mean? They have his name, his number, it's on file.
Right.
That's your first protection. And I actually got into an argument with the 911 operator, and she also told me that a gay man can't be raped, that a gay man can only be sodomized, cannot be raped. And both Ventura Police Department officers had argued the same grounds with me, that you cannot rape a man, you can only sodomize a man. They've somehow labeled it as a lesser crime. And I don't think people realize that.
So there is so much awareness that we really do need to be building here.
Yes. So, you know, that was one of the main reasons why I got so involved in trying to help push that petition to get the FBI to adjust its 83-year-old definition of rape. You know, and that was one of the first steps. This next step, since I am in federal court, my case does have the opportunity to set federal precedent. And one of the key issues, which is key issue number three, that will be decided is does the plaintiff's claim of failure to obtain a rape kit rise to the level of a constitutional violation? Now, I think it does because, for one, I complained of a crime and I wasn't given due process. The officers admitted no investigation into my side of the story was done. Also, what's the point of making molesting someone or raping someone illegal if you will not grant the victim the proper tools to pursue justice?
Right.
Because
exactly.
We all have a right to justice. So that's why this case is so important, and that's another reason why I've pushed so hard to try and get other people involved and share the petition every time someone signs the petition, the governor of California, the mayor of Los Angeles, the president of the city council of Los Angeles, the LAPD, all receive an email stating that so-and-so signed the petition demanding the LAPD give me an apology.
So where can we find this petition to sign it?
That petition can be found on change.org.
Okay.
You can do a very simple search on Google and just Google the words, a gay man can't be raped.
Okay.
And you'll find a number of stories that pop up. Just go to the change.org link. We're just a little over 6,000 signatures now.
We can get that higher.
Yes.
I think we can get that higher. All right, so folks can search for that. Well, here's the thing, James, and the reason your story is just has so much impact and why I wanted you on the show. Because, yes, at the heart of it, there's a court case, there's a battle to get an entire community's voice heard in a way that it's not being heard, that is so damaging. But you, sir, are not someone who said, oh, this is the fight that I, you know, you didn't wake up one day and say, this is the fight that I want to be involved in. And what I so appreciate about you is that you do put yourself out there as someone who says, look, this is not, it's not easy. I didn't wake up and say, I'm going to be an activist for this particular issue. It takes its toll on me as well. And yet you continue to keep on fighting. So I so appreciate you articulating the idea that there is a degree of loneliness around this, that there is a degree of frustration that, you know, that this is a battle. And if there isn't a case like this that we can rally around and support you on as an individual who is fighting for all of us, I don't know what the heck we're doing here. So that is my call to action for all of our listeners, to sign the petition, to do what you can in your own community to support the fight that you've taken on, James.
Thank you. You know, it's one thing people don't realize is that, you know, I've been fighting for 3 years, and there's been some victories here and there. There's been a lot of letdown.
Yeah.
You know, and to invest so many hours of your day, every day for 3 years, and sometimes just feeling like you've gotten nowhere because there's still no direct results yet. I still can't get, you know, like big mainstream media press.
So we're going to see what we can do to support that as well. But at the very least, you know, it all starts, as we say every single week on the show, it all starts with one person telling their story. And not for a second do we want to in any way put out there that this has been easy for you. But I do hope you know how much we appreciate that not just that you came on today and told your story, but that you continue to take on this mantle for our community.
If it wasn't for the support of people like yourself and, like I said, all the wonderful people on Facebook, I don't know if I could have continued this far. I mean, I really do struggle. And you know, that's one thing, like you said, that I've voiced that and I've been honest about that. There's some days that I'm so depressed I can't get out of bed. Other days I don't have a choice because I know I have to be presentable.
Right.
And I have to give an interview, or I have to go before the judge, or I have to do this or that. You know, so it's a struggle. It's a daily, daily struggle.
Well, please know that in the future, and we want to have you back because we want updates on this, you can do this phone call from your bed.
Perfect.
We will not require that you get up. So if that makes it any easier, we're here to help, man.
As long as pajamas is the dress code at this point in time, I'll be.
Would that you knew what I wore for some of these interviews, James. And on that note, James, again, we're keeping you in our thoughts. Folks need to go out there to change.org and sign this petition. And we're going to keep supporting you, James, and we want you back on the show. And you'll give us updates?
Yes, definitely.
All right.
That's what I like to always say to everybody. You are your own best advocate. So speak out, speak up, and speak loud. And, you know, I love you guys, every single one of you, for all of your kind words and your support. And if it wasn't for you, I would not be here and would not be able to carry on. So thank you from the bottom of my heart.
There you go. James Hornick, an absolute pleasure. You are in our thoughts.
Thank you, Tim.
All the best.
Many times I tried to tell you. Many times I cried alone. Always I'm surprised how well you cut my feelings to the bone.
All right, folks, that's all we have time for this week. Our thanks to Bill Clegg and James Hornick for being on this week's episode. Get out there. Go do some incredible things, my friends. And while you're doing them, remember, why be gay when you can be so gay? You're